published a great many articles on issues related to science, education and religion, and has appeared on many media outlets, including Al Jazeera, BBC, NPR and France 2. I also learned this evening that his father was an eminent philosopher who studied Islamic philosophy, and also studied at the Sorbonne. So he got an extraordinary different range of traditions in his household, and all his siblings went into science. And he himself has two teenage sons, both of whom are going into biology. So extremely educated and cultural family. We're very pleased to welcome him here this evening to talk about reconciling Islam and modern science from schizophrenia to harmony. Please would you welcome Professor Nidal Houston.
Thank you so very much. Let me first apologize for the delay and the technical mishap here. These things happen. Thank God there are always backups and alternatives and solutions. Let me first thank the Ian Ramsey Center, Andrew, Peter, Gary, for all the preparation that has been taking several weeks in setting up this lecture or this talk this evening. Also thank my friends from IB Torres, not only for publishing the book, but for also coming this evening and bringing a bunch of books and supporting me and helping launch, since this is a book launch. Here's what I would like to do from the start. I always like to give people an overview of what this is going to be about, so at any moment you know where we are going, and in a moment there will be a slide showing you the outline of the talk, so that there is some kind of a roadmap. About half of the material that I will be speaking about this evening is related to the book, although as you can imagine the book is much more detailed. And about half of the material that I will be talking about this evening is not in the book. There are two reasons for this. One is I would have liked you to come here and hear some stuff and then find it in the book, so it's a repeat. But at the same time, I want to reward the audience for coming and getting bonus or extra rather than just the material from the book. And also because the field of Islam and science is such a diverse field, there are many, many different dimensions to it. I usually refer to it as a three-dimensional volume space where we find items or objects as you would study objects in the universe, as I do sometimes. And so I didn't want you to just get one idea or one main theme, which is what the book discusses, although I will mention at the very end that the book really has a broad spectrum of ideas and topics, but I also wanted you to have a general overview and outlook on what the field of Islam and science is, more generally speaking. So here's the outline of this talk this evening. Let me put all the items on the board. Islam and science yesterday, the history a little bit. This will take only about 5 to 10 minutes because my object is not to speak about the history. But there will be an important idea that I will want to convey that I don't want to get into right away. So that's why I am beginning with a little bit of historical perspective as to what happened in terms of science during the Islamic civilization of the past. Later, contrast it immediately with what is happening today. So I will be giving you a little bit of some data, some perspective, some personal experience as to how science fares nowadays in the Islamic society, in the Muslim world, how people are experiencing it, how people are pursuing it, to what extent is science important or not important in the Islamic society of today, and what are the challenges? What are the challenges? Then some of the important current trends, cultural trends related to science in the Islamic perspective. I'ijaz, which I'll define it a bit later. This is one of the few sort of technical words, if you like, from Arabic or from Islam that I would want to mention. It's such an important topic nowadays in the Islamic world that I have chosen to use the Arabic word, but I will define it more properly later and give you some specific examples. Creationism, which you are all familiar with, but I will give you some information on Muslim creationism, which unfortunately is very strong in the Muslim world today. Then I will move toward the last third of the talk into what I call serious science, Islam discourse. This is unfortunately a discourse that took place mostly in the 70s and the 80s. More recently, that kind of serious discourse subsided, and we don't feel or we don't have that much debate and discourse as to how Islam and science are supposed to interact. So I will be mentioning some of the main voices or some of the main schools of thought that emerged in the 70s and the 80s in the Islamic intellectual sphere regarding modern science versus Islam, what Islam can say or can accept or engage with regard to modern science. And then I will have my own harmonizing, what I call my harmonizing proposal, the spirit of Averroes, that's the connection to the philosophy of my father. I will explain or I will mention why Averroes is important in this regard, even though he lived 8 centuries ago and never heard of what we call modern science and so forth, but why I think he is a very good and useful model to adopt when we talk about modern science today and Islam today. And then in the end, some conclusions, summing up some of the main ideas I would have developed and presenting my brief recommendations as to what I think should be done in the Islamic world in order to take that field of science into its more proper avenue. Here's why I said earlier that I call the field of Islam as a three-dimensional volume, and why I said I wanted to give you a little bit of an overview on each before delving into what is more, perhaps more important for us today and what is the subject of the book. First of all, there is the history part. What was the nature of science during the Islamic civilization? This is one, and that will have some implications as to today. And two, what kind of an impact did the science that was developed in the Islamic civilization have in the general context of humanity and human civilization? There are two reasons why this is important, and I will be just showing you maybe a couple of slides on this in a moment. One is, one of the problems that we will be encountering, one of the problems that the Muslim thinkers, as I said, in the 70s and the 80s tried to address, was what to do with this new brand of science, new type of science that is fully naturalistic, that leaves out God, does not necessarily reject God, but leaves him outside of the realm of discourse and investigation and explanation. God and any supernatural agent cannot be part of the scientific explanatory apparatus nowadays. And so Muslims today say, how come we were able to do science in the past while fully keeping God into the picture, and nowadays modern science says we cannot do that? So that's one of the reasons why people look back to history. Number two, for maybe purely apologetic or defensive reasons, Muslims feel that the Islamic civilization has not been given its dues in terms of what it has contributed, at least in terms of science. So that's one field, and there are many, many books up to today, many researchers who pursue this line of investigation, very often with new findings, new manuscripts and new ideas, etc. To what extent, for example, the Muslims had prepared the field for the Copernican Revolution or things like this. Practical issues. Islam is one religion that needs a lot of scientific input or scientific reference, scientific help in terms of the practice of the religion itself. I will be showing you some examples of that a little bit later, very briefly. But then, of course, what is mostly of most of greatest importance to me and to people today is the philosophical issues. The relationship, as I said, between modern science and Islam in terms of the knowledge that has been brought nowadays, the theories that have been developed, the position of religion in the general knowledge, context of knowledge, and so forth. Islam and science yesterday, let me show you an example from about a year and a half ago. This is Jim Al-Khalili, who is probably very familiar to most of you, a British physicist of Iraqi origin who has received awards for his popularization attempts here, etc., has had books and TV series and so forth, had a BBC TV series about a year and a half ago titled Science and Islam. And in there, in one of the episodes, I think it was 3 episodes or 4 episodes, they're all on YouTube for anyone who wants to watch, he says the following. These are taken verbatim from his show. Isaac Newton is the undisputed father of modern optics. Also, we are told at school. Yet, in the field of optics, Newton himself stood on the shoulders of a giant who lived 700 years earlier. Without doubt, another great physicist who is worthy of ranking up alongside Newton, this is a tremendous claim, I do not subscribe, not nearly enough to this claim, but this is what Jim is saying. Of ranking up alongside Newton is Al-Hasan ibn al-Haytham, known in the West, by the way, as Al-Hazen, A-L-H-A-Z-E-N, Al-Hazen. Ibn al-Haytham is regarded as the father of the modern scientific method. This I, again, do not subscribe to, but that's what Jim says. Most people in the West will never have even heard of him. So that tells you two things, the two ideas that I had mentioned briefly earlier. One is that there had been in the Islamic civilization some genuine, innovative, scientific work, since Jim is talking about the scientific method, talking about optics. Ibn al-Haytham, this I certainly agree with. Ibn al-Haytham revolutionized optics, is the one who developed many experiments in terms of reflection and refraction and the usage of lenses and so on and so forth. But also, because, as you see in the last statement, he says, most people in the West will never heard of him, meaning people have not really done the historical homework and have not given these people their dues. So this is one example. And I jump very quickly because this is my objective here is not to publicize such things. Other great scientists and their philosophies. Again, I'm trying to just pick on the philosophy of science that was developed during those times. Al-Kindi, who is usually referred to as the first philosopher of the Arabs, 9th century, Al-Kindi wrote, this is again from him, our goal must be to garner the truth from wherever it may come, for nothing is of higher priority to the seeker of truth than truth. This may sound like, okay, very nice statement, and of course, and everybody would agree with this, but you will see later why this is important, especially since this was stated more than 1,000 years ago, and you will find that today the Islamic culture does not subscribe to this, at least in practice. In speech, yes, people will say, of course, truth and higher and blah blah blah, but in practice you will find that that is not true. So this is important. This is in Al-Kindi. Avicenna, Ibn Sina, on the importance of requiring proof. He says, he who gets used to believing without proof has slipped out of his natural humanness. Again, you will find that this principle, which sounded like very clear, strong, important principle to the Muslim scholars then, Ibn Sina lived 1,000 years ago, nowadays is not implemented or upheld. Ibn Sina, and finally Al-Biruni, these are some of the greatest scientists of their time and of the Islamic civilization. Al-Biruni adopted induction as the valid approach for research and debated it with Ibn Sina, induction being a bottom-up approach, Avicenna remained a deductionist, in the philosophical sense or in the mathematical sense. You start with a principle that people sort of think is clearly, obviously true, and then you deduct truths or results from that, and they debated. There's a hugely interesting correspondence between Biruni and Avicenna, where one is sort of explaining why the other method cannot be the better method and why this one is true or not true. Science in the Islamic culture. In the Islamic culture, and this I emphasize in the book, the Quran, the scripture, the holy book, plays an exceedingly central role and is held in a very high place. Everything that the Muslims believe, everything that they are going to abide by, has to somehow be related to the Quran. And this I find in my experience, in my practice of science and debates with people, etc., is an important principle to keep in mind. We need to tell people, I always feel that I need to tell people where the Quran stands with regard to this or to that. And so with regard to science in general, one of the problems with the Islamic culture is that the word for science, ilm, for those who know, is the same as the word for knowledge. And so it is very hard to tell sometimes when this word is meant in the science meaning, not even modern science, but just science, and when it is meant as just knowledge. In any case, we find verses such as, there are many, many verses in the abstract that I sent for the talk of this evening. I refer to Abdus Salam, who I'll be mentioning a little bit later, the first Muslim to receive the Nobel Prize in Physics, when was this, about 30 years ago, 1979, used to always repeat that in the Quran you will find out of about 6,000 verses, at least 700 verses that talk about nature and the pursuit of knowledge and exploration and things like this, compared to only about 200 and 250 verses that have some kind of a description of the life of the Muslim, how people should live or what they should do or what they shouldn't do, etc. So we find verses like this reflect on what is in the heavens and the earth, he who created everything and ordered it in exact measure, the idea that there are laws in the universe, and as many of you know, I'm sure, this is a tremendously important idea, because historians like Peter Harrison and others have been arguing why modern science as we know it emerged in the West and not in the East, not in China, for example, or in other places, because the monotheistic cultures had these ideas that there is order, that there are laws, that there was a creator, and that he set it up from a certain blueprint. So that we find, of course, in the Quran, because it's the same continuation of the same ideas, roughly, as the Bible. Say, travel in the land and see how he originated creation. The reason why I like to cite this verse in the Quran is because it emphasizes travel in the land in order to discover things and see, etc., meaning observation, exploration, etc. It's not just sit there and contemplate and see how God did, it is go out there and find things. Now, the second important source of religious knowledge, at least in Islam, is the hadith, the statements from the Prophet, and the following tradition. We find statements, many, many statements of this kind. We find statements like, the ink of the scholar is more sacred than the blood of the martyr, seek knowledge even in China, and hours contemplation or study of nature is better than a year's adoration of God. An hour of scientific work or even philosophical thing is more important than a year's adoration of God. And then finally, God put out there a cure for every disease he created, meaning go and find it. So you find again a combination of reason, contemplation, thinking, observation meaning mental observation, and then experimental, observational exploration, go in the land and find and seek and research. Special Islamic needs for science. Now, this is the second dimension. This is the practical dimension. Sometimes Muslims refer to the utilitarian nature of science, and people emphasize, well, I'll be coming back a little bit later to this, that Muslims, one of the Muslim thinkers, one of their critiques of modern science is that most of it is not of almost any utility, and that science, for it to be valuable, for it to be commendable for humans to pursue, has to have direct benefit for humanity. And so we find that there are many religious injunctions or religious practices in the Islamic life that are directly related to science. Many are related to astronomy, so these are the things that I know best, in particular the direction of Mecca and people quickly, because of course, since long ago people knew that the earth was round, I mean the flat earth is of course a myth that most people buy, even the first few centuries AD knew that the earth was round. And so knowing that the earth is round, and you have to know and you have to direct your prayer toward Mecca, people had to develop geodesics and had to develop spherical trigonometry, and all of that was done way, way, way early because of the religious need. prayer times, as I'm sure all of you know, the Muslims pray five times a day, at specific times or specific periods, time intervals that are directly related to the position of the sun in the sky during the day or at night, above the horizon or below the horizon. These are shown here very diagrammatically in this second thing. But again, as I say, these are just introductory ideas or just overviews. And I don't have time, if you like, during the discussion, I'll be more than happy to detail all of these things, which, as I said, are closer to my expertise, so I know these things. So Muslims had to develop knowledge of astronomy and trigonometry in order to be able to determine these prayer times, which vary from location to location. Prayer times here in London are not the same as prayer times in my place in Sharjah in the United Emirates, or in South Africa, or in Mecca, etc., and vary through the year. So prayer times, even here in Oxford, in November are not the same as in March, and are not the same as in June, and so on. So all of that had to be developed for religious purposes. Crescent-based months and calendars, again, this is another issue that is still with us very strongly and is driving us crazy, because Muslims, for various reasons, which again I'll be happy to go into if you like later, have not been able to resolve this issue of when the Muslim months are supposed to begin. Ramadan, Shawwal, which is the end of Ramadan, Eid, etc. This is one of the reasons why I couldn't tell you 2 weeks ago when I would be able to travel. It's because just 2 days ago was the second most important holiday or feast in the Islamic calendar, and that could not be decided. It should be decided. I mean, I can put together, and I have made proposals and written papers on the Islamic calendar issue, but for religious reasons, for sometimes political reasons, etc., this has not been resolved. But in any case, what I mean is, because of these needs, the Muslim scholars had to develop specific scientific knowledge in order to address these questions. This is just a crescent illustration, and then many others, not just in astronomy. I mean, I highlighted in blue the things that have to do with astronomy and trigonometry, but some others, some others that have to do with mathematics, the inheritance laws, for example, Al-Khwarizmi, who is widely and correctly credited for having developed algebra, when one reads the very first book where he starts to present this new method, algebra is a method, it's how you set up an equation. Even the word algebra in Arabic means how you set up an equation and how you transpose one term to the other side and put a minus sign and things like this. The way he explains the utility of this method is, he says, suppose you have a woman who dies and she has left a certain sum of money, and because of the specific inheritance laws in Islam, you have to know how to divide and how to subtract, and this person will get one third and this person will get two thirds, and this person, but you will have to subtract whatever loans she had before, and so on and so forth. And he says, the only way you can do that is by setting it up as an equation and then solving it. In other words, I'm not saying he developed all of algebra because of this, but one of the immediate practical applications that he saw and presented to people in order to convince them of the utility of this new science is the inheritance laws of Islam. Medicine, architecture, etc. Mosques have to be aligned in the direction of Mecca and so on and so forth. Now today, let's jump to today and see how the situation looks. Let me put all the depressing information on the screen right away. Out of about 2,000 universities in the Muslim world, few, maybe two or three, are in the top 500 of the world. And even those that are in the top 500 are all ranked between 400 and 500, meaning there are no universities in all of the Muslim world that are in the top 400 in the world. This tells you something. Number of scientific publications originating in the Muslim world today is barely 1%. Now compare this to the ratio of population. Muslims nowadays make up 20 to 25%. So 20 or 25% of people in the world produce only about 1% of scientific publications. 1999, in terms of patents, technological innovation, only 134 patents were registered in the whole Muslim region, compared to more than 3,000 in Israel alone. Now, if you divide this by population, so as to get it per capita, then you can imagine what kind of a contrasting ratios you would be getting. In fact, the very next item does that, divides by population in order to get something per capita. Number of frequently cited scientific papers per million people, and you can see the numbers, 0.02 in Egypt, 0.07 in Saudi Arabia, 0.01 in my country of Algeria, etc., compared to 38 in Israel, 43 in the USA, 80 in Switzerland, meaning roughly about a factor of 1,000 to 10,000 more. Something is wrong in the world of Islam nowadays in terms of science production. Now, this is a very complex issue, and that's not the topic of my talk today. It's not to explore why is science faring so badly. I'm just trying to present to you what is the situation, and then I will focus on some aspects of the general picture. Let's look at science education in the Arab Muslim world. Maybe it is because we are not teaching science correctly, maybe. Or maybe we are teaching science correctly, but then later we don't have good universities. Or maybe we don't have the resources. Or maybe we are not spending enough on research. Or things like this. I mean, there could be a million factors. So let's just look at science education, just to begin with. In 2007, there was this TIMSS test, which is an international test that is run voluntarily by countries who want to participate in it. Usually about 30, 40 countries like to participate. They bring their representative students, about 50 to 100 students, and they enter these tests, which are given in science and in mathematics, at grade 4 and grade 8. And then there's a comparison of the results. So here are the scores for 4th grade students by country in science. And I have all the results for mathematics, etc., but I will focus only on science. 500 is sort of the benchmark, the average score. If you score above 500, it means you're doing well as a country. The more you score low, below the 500, the more you are terrible. What I want you to take a look at is what I have highlighted in red arrows, which are the bottom, among the 30 to 40 countries that participated in this 2007 sort of science competition, if you like, the bottom 7 countries who scored were all from the Muslim world. And you can see them there. The green ones are the good ones, the highest one being Singapore. You can see England, 542, not bad, but not among the top. But you can see the others, some of them, including Qatar, some of the richer countries. It has nothing to do with rich or poor, by the way. And you can see how bad it is. I mean, really, really below the 500 level. Let's take a look very quickly at grade 8. Again, the green are the good ones. England, again 542, but this time much closer to the top since Singapore is at 567. And then you can see on the right, these are the bottom 17 or so countries. And out of the 17 bottom countries, you can see that 13 of them are from the Muslim world. Some of them extremely low. In terms of science education, there is quite a bit of catching up to do. So that's one serious problem. Another serious problem is what I want to focus on a little bit more now, in the second part of my talk. This is the second third of my talk. Current trends in the Islam science discourse, so to speak, in the Muslim society nowadays. These are cultural trends. There are two dominant cultural trends. Remember the word i'jaz that I mentioned in the outline at the beginning, and I said I'll come back to this because it's a major, major problem. I'jaz stands for miraculous scientific content in the Quran. Now, I'll be coming back to this a little bit in a moment. But basically, what many, many writers, many, 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 and speakers on TV and everywhere around me, I have gotten sick and tired of this. I have a whole chapter in the book devoted to this, believe it or not, trying to rebut and trying to show people that this is not only incorrect, but this is counterproductive for the Islamic culture and civilization. They claim that there are tens, hundreds, of statements, verses from the Quran, where they will claim we can show that there is some scientific information in this statement, and since this was revealed 1400 years ago, then clearly this predates any scientific discovery, and therefore the Quran is way ahead, or has been way ahead, and clearly is of divine nature. Second trend, I'll come back to this with some stunning examples. Second dominant trend is creationism. Creationism, of course, is not found only in the Islamic culture. It is widespread in the Islamic culture, but it's not only in the Islamic culture of today. I mean, you can find perhaps even more creationism in the United States than you can find in other countries, in other Muslim countries. But the situation is pretty bad. Again, because I won't have time to develop all these ideas, I just want to mention for those of you who are interested, next month in December, I have a paper coming out in Zygon on literalism, the effect of literalism, scriptural literalism, on the scientific discourse of Islam today, contemporary Islam. So I try to explain why we have at least Muslim creationism, and probably Christian creationism as well, can be, in my view, directly attributed to literal interpretations of the scriptures. But this is a dominant trend. So the Quran becomes a scientific reference and authority. This is the first conclusion that we draw from both of these examples, because you can see in the first one, and these are the two by far strongest cultural trends in the Islamic world today, in the first one, science is found directly in the Quran, or taken directly from the Quran, or claimed to that. And in the second, some attitude with respect to science, in this case, biological and human evolution, is judged by the Quranic yardstick. In fact, the Muslim... I think there's some information missing down there, but... in the Islamic culture of today, we find this authority principle playing a disproportionate role. Scholars, leaders, religious texts, and received knowledge become the authority. Not reason, not established knowledge. People always talk to me and say, yes, of course, but you have replaced one authority with another, and your authority is science, whereas our authority is the religious scholars. And I say, no, my authority is not science. My authority is established knowledge. If you and I can agree that it is established knowledge that the earth goes around the sun and not the other way around, then that becomes an automatic fact. Now, you may call it authority or whatever, I don't mind. But you cannot accuse me of having an authority when you and I agree on that being a fact. And many, many other statements like this. Do you accept that there are atoms in the world, or do you think that that's just a fancy theory? Do you accept that we can date fossils, or do you think that this is just a fancy conspiracy? Do you accept that there is, and the list can be very, very long as to what I refer to as established knowledge. Now let me give you some examples about this scientific content in the Quran. In March 2008, just to show you that this is still ongoing, very strongly ongoing, there was the ninth international world conference on the miraculous scientific content in the Quran, unfortunately again held in my country of Algeria. But that's the ninth one. I will say later that the eighth one was in Kuwait, the tenth one this year is supposed to take place in Turkey, of all places, and so on. Under the patronage of President Bouteflika himself. So this is the conference that is sponsored and patronized by the President himself and organized by the World Authority. This is an international world authority which is based in Saudi Arabia on miraculous science in the Quran and Sunnah, Sunnah being the practice and tradition of the Prophet Muhammad. The Prime Minister in his opening speech, so this is a conference opened by the Prime Minister under the patronage of the President, and the Prime Minister said, verbatim, many researchers and scientists have ended up admitting that many of their discoveries and inventions in fact exist in the Quran. This is in 2008. I just wanted to show you to what extent this is prevalent and dominant. As I said, in 2006, December 2006, the 8th conference, the previous one in the series, which is held every 2 years, was held in Kuwait by the same world authority. Now, just to give you an idea, what kind of talks, what kind of papers, etc., are given at such conferences, 86 papers were presented in that conference in parallel sessions, because 86 papers, you have to run them in parallel, on topics such as the miracle in the descent of iron from the sky, the scientific miracle in the Quran's description of the movement of shadows, the superiority of the treatment of lower backs by prayers over the treatment by lasers, the scientific miracle in the prophetic statement regarding remedying by vinegar, and the list can be much, much longer. I have many more examples in the book. Another conference in April 2007, this time in the United Arab Emirates in Abu Dhabi, on Quranic healing. Again, this is not just to make fun of things, this is really to show to what extent the Quran plays such a central role that people go back to it again and again and again, and to what extent this is how people understand or view science in relation to their faith. Again, 1,300 people attended this conference in Abu Dhabi on Quranic healing, how the recitation of verses of the Quran on water, how you would read the Quran on water and then drink it, and how it would cure you of all kinds of ills and so forth, protection from magic, demons, evil eye, etc., etc. The conference recommendations, these are the recommendations from the conference attended by big scholars and officials, included a call to set up government clinics for the practice of Quranic healing. Muslim creationism now. Here's a recent survey which appeared in the journal Science in December 2008, a survey of attitudes, positions of people with regard to biological evolution. So they would go to people and say, do you think the theory of evolution, biological evolution meaning Darwin's, etc., is? Now, the green here, which really should have been drawn in red because this is the bad stuff, is true or probably true. Could not possibly be true. So, the theory of evolution could not possibly be true. You can see this is Egypt, for those of you in the back who may not be able to see all the words. Egypt, Malaysia, Pakistan, Indonesia, Turkey, Kazakhstan. Kazakhstan is a special case, as you can imagine. But in Egypt, Malaysia, Pakistan, Indonesia, and Turkey, 50 to 60% of surveyed people say the theory of evolution could not possibly be true. Now, this is the black stuff here, another 15 to 20, 25% say probably false. Now, the purple here is, I have never thought about it, so I'm not sure. And then only this part here are those who say that it is true or probably true, who even give Darwinian evolution a chance. And that, as you can see, is only about 10 to 25% or so. Kazakhstan is a special case, as you can imagine, because Kazakhstan, with all the Soviet background, is a different place. But even in Kazakhstan, if you count those who say, could not possibly be true, probably false, never heard about it, you're already at more than 60%. Meaning, at best, 40% say, the theory of biological evolution is probably true. Now, why is that? There is total fixation with human evolution. If you talk to people, it's always, what about Adam? It's not about, what is the evidence? Is it true? How does it work? What do you mean by mutation? DNA, as we were talking over dinner, could that be true? How does it work? Do you really believe that natural selection could select this characteristic or that? It's never that kind of discussion. It's always, what about Adam? And what about the verses in the Quran where God says that He created Adam and He created Eve and they were in the garden, paradise, or wherever that was, and they fell or they erred and were taken out and so on. It's always, the discussion is always about Adam. And there is, as you can see, large, even people, by the way, even this could be misleading, even this could be very optimistic. All these results, which I think are pretty depressing, but even these results could be largely optimistic. Why? Because these are talking about the theory of evolution in general. They are not even talking about human evolution. Even people who say, oh, biological evolution, that species evolved after species, all of that, yeah, I don't mind, but probably, okay, etc. Except for humans, they always insist. Except for humans. If you take out humans, then I'm open to discussion. But if you put humans in there, then that's a no-no. I don't have time to mention Harun Yahya, the Turkish famous person who has now run a very strong campaign for the past 15, 20 years, trying to discredit evolution and other such things, and has been successful because he has huge means and resources, has teams of followers in various countries. I have seen them in the United Arab Emirates operating. And they have been successful not only in influencing people, going to campuses, talking to students, etc., but influencing the officials into removing any traces of evolution from the biological curricula. This I have witnessed myself. Here's another survey I ran personally at my university. This was in about 3 years ago, 2-3 years ago, I did this. The interesting thing about my university is that it is a very, very diverse university. It has about, in terms of students, we have about 70 nationalities of students. And in terms of professors, faculty members, we have about 50 nationalities. So you can see we have a huge diversity. In terms of faculty members in particular, we are split roughly about 50-50, maybe 40%, 60%. Of Muslims and Westerners. And so it was it's an interesting laboratory for me to test. In fact, I had the survey with many questions like this. These are only, I'm going to show you only two of the questions that I posed to the people that I surveyed via students. The first page was, are you a faculty member? Are you a student? Are you Muslim, non-Muslim, Arab, Asian, Westerner, etc.? I mean, I had to really sort of sift through, and I had all the data that could be analyzed in various ways. Male, female, Westerner, Easterner, Muslim, non-Muslim, youngster versus older fellow, and so on and so forth. So that's why you can see that I am able to compare the views of students with the views of Muslim professors and the views of non-Muslim professors. By the way, for those of you who are very careful about these things, sometimes the numbers may add up to a little bit more than 100%, but that's because sometimes people would choose two answers at the same time. Anyway, so in this question I asked people whether they think that evolution, basically, is evolution true? Or is evolution just some unproven theory? And these are the three possible answers that I gave them. So evolution is just an unproven theory, I don't believe in it. Or evolution is correct except for humans. Or evolution is strongly confirmed by evidence. Now you can see for yourselves, I mean, look at non-Muslim professors, because they have studied this and because they have come to accept it, etc., by and large accept evolution as being confirmed by evidence. Whereas Muslim students and Muslim professors, and the numbers are very interestingly almost identical, which means it doesn't make much difference. Only about 10-15%, just like as we saw previously in the general surveys, which is one of my findings actually, that in the Islamic world, creationism versus evolutionism is not subject or is not dependent on the level of education. Evolution is correct except for humans. Now here some people start to say, okay, and there I can go with you. And then evolution is just, I don't believe in it, as you can see, almost two-thirds. Another interesting question, the next three items here, is should we teach evolution? Again, three possibilities I gave to people. I said evolution is against religion, it should not be taught. Or evolution should be taught, but as just a theory, which is of course the misconception of the word theory, but let's skip that. And then evolution should be taught as a strong theory, meaning a theory that has been confirmed by evidence. And again, you can see the difference between non-Muslim professors and the Muslim faculty. Again, almost identical numbers here in the two, in the first two columns. And here it is either don't teach it or teach it as a theory. But don't teach it as really something important and serious that we should stand up and pay attention to. Now, I don't want to depress you completely. So I want to show you a little bit some of the positive signs, because I mean, really, truly, it's not correct, and it's not nice to draw, you know, black and white picture, mostly black, so because it's not true. Women have made huge strides in higher education, in science, and in research in the Arab Muslim world. This is one of the big pluses that I personally am most happy about, and I'll show you some data in a moment. Large increases in research spending. Qatar has now targeted a 2.8% spending on research from its GDP. Now you may say, those of you who know these figures, 2.8% is nice, but it's not extraordinary. I mean, there are countries in the world that spend 4 or 5%. The average throughout the whole world is 2%. Throughout the whole world. But believe it or not, in most, maybe 90% or more of the Arab Muslim countries, and countries that identify themselves as Muslim, meaning with the majority of Muslim population, number 57, there are 57 such countries. And very few of them have spending on research and development that is above the average of the world, 2%. So this is, but at least there is some progress. I mean, at least we're moving into that direction. There's emergence of new well-endowed research funding agencies in the Gulf. There are new science and technology parks popping up here and there. So this is all very encouraging. There's a slow, but there is a start of science activity in the media. Some magazines appearing, some science blogs. Believe it or not, only a few months ago, I saw the first Arab science blog appear on the blogosphere, which is extremely encouraging. You might think one blog, and the person whom I know writes once a week on just science issues, but still, to me, that's incredibly nice. An Arab Science Journalists Association was founded in 2006, but with financing to TBD, to be determined. So at least there is the association. They don't have much funding, but at least they exist. First Arab Science Journalism Conference held in Morocco in October 2008. So science is coming back to the general culture, let's say. I said I would show you some figures. On the left, this is female enrollment at universities in the world. At universities, meaning if you go to a typical university or an average university in the Arab world, let's say you go to the UAE where I live, or go to Algeria where I'm from, or go to Egypt or something, what is the fraction of women students, female students, compared to the total number of students? And as you can see, in some places, it is almost 80%. And 80%, look where, Qatar, United Emirates, Saudi Arabia, the most conservative countries. So it's not about conservatism. These 60, 75, 80%, in some places like Yemen, well, no need to explain about Yemen, 30% or 25%. And these are the Western countries. As you can see, so if you average out the Arab world here, it's not so bad in terms of how many girls are going to universities, in general. Now, what I want to focus on, yes?
We've got about 10 or 15 minutes left, we start a bit late. Just in case you want to talk about the principles part at the end.
Very good, okay, thanks, yeah, I'll get to that quickly. This is for the science part now. This is what sort of encourages me and gives me more pleasure. Again, if you go to a university and say and ask the administrators how many female students are studying physics, majoring in physics, or biology, or some of the science disciplines, compared to the total number of students going into the sciences, that's the fraction. Again, Qatar, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, look, almost 80%, 70%, 75%. And you can see all of this is the Arab world and all of this is the Western world. In most of the Western world, the fraction of females, of students, female students going into the sciences is less than about 40%. Whereas in most of the Arab world, most of it is more than 40, 50%. So there are some positive trends there. These are the Arab girls and so on. Now I get to the conceptual science-Islam issues. As I mentioned early on, in the 70s and 80s, there was quite a bit of discourse as to how should we Muslims react to this new development, relatively new development, I mean recent in the sense that it appeared over the past three centuries or so, the scientific revolution. And three main schools attempted to properly define the relation between Islam and science. There is the sacred science approach of Nasser, say Hussein Nasser, I'll come back to these with one slide each in a moment. There is the ethical science of Sardar and his group, the Ijmalis. There is the universal science, Abdus Salam, the Nobel Prize winner that I mentioned, and I'll come back to him in a moment. And other writers usually add a couple more voices or trends. The miraculous science in the Quran that I mentioned earlier, meaning basically there's nothing new in this science, it was all in the Quran anyway, so case closed, that's the discussion. And then there is the science should be a search for God and not just a knowledge pursuit, discover what we discover. And then there is the Islamic theistic science, which is closest to my viewpoint. This is Golshani, Mehdi Golshani, whom I won't have time to describe in any detail. Mehdi Golshani is an Iranian physicist who has been writing on these subjects in very, very good ways. He has some books in English and some in other languages. So let's look briefly at these. This is Sayyid Hussein Nasr, an Iranian thinker who has lived in the U.S. since the Iranian Revolution, meaning 1979, defends this sacred science idea. Now, you will realize very quickly that I disagree very strongly with this approach. He considers modern science a human anomaly. Why is it a human anomaly? Because he says, for the first time in the history of humanity, we have developed a science that removes God from the picture. Now, he says, not only is that an anomaly, not only is that wrong, but it's an anomaly because he believes, he says, sooner than later, we will correct that mistake. Humanity, meaning, will correct that mistake. We will come back. God will be brought back. So don't be too fooled or too impressed with this modern science triumph. It's a temporary fad. So he lists kinds of problems and he insists, again I disagree even with this historical description, insists that science and the Islamic civilization considered nature as sacred, the cosmos being a unified realm of material and spiritual beings, where he says it has to be looked at together in a unified manner. All Muslims, and probably all believers, believe that there is a spiritual dimension to humans, that's what defines religion, really. The belief in spirit, in spirituality, in some other dimension to humanities, to humans, other than just the physical body. But most people tend to distinguish between the two, separate. Angels are one thing, planets and stars are something else. Physical, spiritual are not things that you put in the same model, in the same equation, so to speak. But Nasser refuses that. He says, no, they should be included together. And then he adds, he says, access to information can be by reason or by individual intuition, including mystical exercises. In other words, if you want to come up with the next invention or the next theory or the next equation, you can just undergo or undertake mystical exercises and come up with new knowledge instead of reason, methodology, and so on. And then finally, he rejects the objectives of modern science, what we know as confirmation by repeatability, falsification, Karl Popper, etc., accuracy, and so on. He says all of that is just details, it's not so important, that's not what's important. What is important is really the values of purpose, meaning, beauty, harmony. That's the stick by which we should be judging theories, not to what extent it is accurate or fits observations or experiments and so on. Second person, this is Zia Sardar, who lives in London, really, has lived in London ever since, I think, 14, when his family immigrated from Pakistan. Very, very knowledgeable and cultured person. And he's not that old, also, I think he's only 55 or 56. Anyway, has written tremendously, at least in the 70s and the 80s, on Islam and science. His view is that modern science is flawed and dangerous, both for its metaphysical basis, but also and particularly because of the effects of its applications. He never tires repeating all the problems that science, which I think really should be technology, or at least some technology, has about, meaning pollution, environment, some diseases, Hiroshima, and so on and so forth, some things like this. But he blames it on modern science. Puts more importance in the social relevance of science than in its epistemological objectives. He said, science, if you think that modern science is good or is bad, or the Islamic science was good or was bad, you need to judge it by how much it benefited society, not by how closely it fit some of the observations or some experimental measurements. And then he cites a number of Islamic principles that he says, these are the basis upon which science in general, even human science, not just Islamic science, should be based on, like divine unity, human trusteeship of earth, knowledge and worship, justice, public interest, etc. So this is Zia Sardar. Third and last example I want to pick up on, because I really don't have time to explain all of these. By the way, these three slides here are a summary of chapter 4, I think, in the book. If you're interested in these things, you can read the details. Abdus Salam is, that's the first item here, first Muslim Nobel Prize winner in physics, 1979, a devout but rationalist Muslim. Now, there are all kinds of issues as to what kind of branch of Islam he belonged to and whether he was really sort of in the main branch of Islam. I don't care about any of those aspects. He defined himself as Muslim. I met him before his death, had long discussions with him. He fully defines himself as Muslim. To me, he's Muslim. I don't care what people will proclaim. Now, what does Abdus Salam say? He insists that science is universal and only its applications are affected by cultural factors. So he says, there is no such thing. In fact, I have the quotes right here. He says, there is no Islamic science, because the phrase Islamic science was in vogue for years and years. There are many, many books were written with this Islamic science, whether contemporary or past. And he said, there is no such thing as Islamic science. That's just science. Science is universal. Just like there is no Chinese science, no Indian science, no Hindu science, or Jewish science. He does not believe there are any serious metaphysical, conceptual problems in modern science. He says, the problems of modern science are not in its foundations. That's not the problem. So there is nothing to reconstruct. It's not like, okay, we need to redo science. Science as it has been done in the past two, three centuries is seriously flawed or is an anomaly, as Nasser would have put it. And so, of course, you can imagine that even people who don't agree with him have labeled him as conventionalist, a modernist, universalist, a business as usual guy. It's like, okay, there's nothing to worry about, just continue as we have been doing, etc. So that's Abdus Salam. Now, my viewpoint, this is Averroes, Ibn Rushd in Arabic, in his real name. Averroes, who lived in the 12th century in Andalusia in Spain, one of the greatest, if not the greatest, Muslim philosopher of all times. What did Averroes do that I think should be relevant 8 centuries later? As I said earlier, Averroes had never mentioned science, never heard of modern science, never heard of naturalism, meaning that all explanations have to be from natural causes, and so on and so forth. He never dealt with any of these issues. So what makes him an important model for me to adopt and follow his spirit? Averroes dealt with the problem of how to harmonize between philosophy, classical Aristotelian Greek rational type philosophy, and Islam. And he wrote some books on trying to show how to harmonize the two. And basically what he says is two things. He says, if you're a believer, as he was, then you automatically, naturally believe that there cannot be any conflict between the two. Because, as he put it, how could truth contradict truth? He says, this is truth. Whatever we arrived at, what I called earlier established knowledge, whatever we establish, what we reach for certainty, and today with science, we reach certain knowledge, absolutely established knowledge, much, much more than they, in their times, were able to establish through philosophy. He says, but if you are able to establish things as truthful, and if you believe that your religious beliefs, your creed, your scripture, your verses, etc. are also true, then there's no way they can contradict each other. They said people, but sometimes there is some, at least apparent contradiction. So what do? You cannot just say, oh, they cannot contradict, I'm going to go home. If they appear to contradict each other, he says, whatever is established truth takes precedence automatically. Either way, if this verse is of explicit, very clear, confirmed meaning and established through history, etc., then that takes precedent, and then you have to take a look at whatever your reasoning was and say there must be some flaw here. Or vice versa, he says, if you establish something from reason and you know that this is true, and then you read your scripture and you find that it doesn't fit, it means your scripture needs to be reinterpreted. That's the simplest summary I can give of the spirit or the principle of Averroes. So, what I say, okay, a couple minutes, no problem. Adopt modern science in all its rigorous methodology and results. What I mean by results is confirmed results. So, we must accept the methodology of science. We cannot just play with it and say, oh, this is not quite sure, etc. And two, whatever is, as I said earlier, we can draw, we can agree on a list of whatever the scientific community will say, this is certain, there's no going back. It's not like next century we'll be saying again, oh, maybe it's the sun that's going around the Earth, no, that's gone. Or maybe the galaxy is actually 100 times smaller than we actually know today, no, that's gone. It's not going to be that way. So there's a long list of things that we can establish already. Science is not just, as people mistakenly believe and keep claiming, say, oh yeah, but science, you for you one day, Pluto is a planet, the next day Pluto is not a planet. So how can we listen to you guys? I say, no, but you have to distinguish between whatever is labels. I can call this a planet, I can call it a Netpla tomorrow, I can change the label, change the name. But whatever is established result, knowledge, not what I decided to call upon. But that requires some real understanding of science, and I will be mentioning that when we get to the conclusions later. Add an optional theistic interpretative layer. Now this is a very important idea or principle that I am proposing. Meaning that if you are a believer, and I am a believer, then your belief, your religion, your dogma, your creed can only come at the interaction with science as an interpretative layer, not into the practice and the methodology itself. You cannot mix the two into the practice itself, but you can, once you have established whatever you have established, then you come and you say, but because I believe that there is a God, or because I believe that there is an afterlife, or because I believe that there is prophecy, or because I believe that there is spirit, then to me this fits this way. And then you are free. That's why I call it an optional theistic interpretative layer. Then you're free. If you say, but I'm not a believer, I don't accept what you're saying, I say, okay, fine. Then for you, there is no such layer, there may be another interpretation, or there may be another layer. That's how the two can interface. Universally imposed stringent ethical standards like those of Islam, and again, I don't have time to explain all of this, accept the Quran's guidance and philosophy of knowledge, make hermeneutics. Hermeneutics is this interpretative exercise that I mentioned earlier, whenever there is any apparent, when there is any apparent contradiction with modern science. So I'll skip very quickly. Now, this is my book. This is the shameless plug, as we call it. But just to give you an idea of what the book, but you have the book here, so you can consult this later. So you can see the first part, which is the first four chapters, is God, the Quran, and science, and how they sort of connect in various ways in the past and today. Part two is the special topics. So there's a chapter on each one of these: cosmology, design and fine-tuning, anthropic principle, evolution. Part three is what I call future Islam, Islam and science discourse, meaning all the tough topics that I only addressed briefly, because they require a lot of work and a lot of discussion. Divine action, miracles, prayers, etc. All of these are discussed. It's not that I escaped them or eluded them, but in the future I believe that Muslim thinkers will be called upon to address these more in detail. Now, very quick summary. First, so that it's a two-part summary, there are two slides here. First, the diagnostic. Okay, so what have we found? Serious problems facing science in the Muslim world today. Low priority, it's mostly technology-oriented, the nature of science is largely misunderstood, mediocre science education, all the ills that I mentioned earlier, and each one of these really requires lots of discussion and writing. There's issues of freedom of inquiry. There are certain topics that are sort of no-no, or you have to be careful, and you cannot publicize too much your adherence to Darwin or something like this. So there's issues of freedom of inquiry. There's issues of harmonization between received wisdom and new knowledge. It's not always so easy for people to fit the two. All of the stuff that I have received, whether from scripture or from my parents or from my upbringing, etc., and what I'm receiving from education, new knowledge. And then there's the practice, scientists, educators, media people, and how we all need to make more effort into putting science into a more rightful place. Recommendations, finally, this is my last slide. We need to teach the philosophy of science widely. This is one of the problems that I have identified in my part of the world. Philosophy of science is not taught, or almost never. And that's one of the problems into people not understanding the nature of science and then mixing it up with belief and how things change and what is true today and may not be true tomorrow and things like this. Use the tradition of endowments to support science and encourage patronage. This is just sort of on the practical side of funding. We need to set up forums, academies, conferences, blogs, etc. to discuss and publicize science, its paradigms, its social implications, etc. This is not nearly enough done. There is no journal of history of science in the whole Arab world, believe it or not. There is no journal of philosophy of science in the whole Arab world, believe it or not. There is no real serious discussion of science in its various dimensions. And then finally, entice bright minds to go into science for both self-satisfaction and for contribution at the world and humanity level. Thank you all very much for your patience.